Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And we've touched on or hitting on a major topic, I think, in both the Nucleus Investment Insights series and, of course, the Australian psyche, I think, an investment psyche. And so we're going to be looking today at Australian housing boom and bust indicators to focus on. As always, a pretty big topic, and we've got plenty of data in there. Really looking forward to today. I'm joined, as always, by our head of investments for Nucleus Wealth and MB Fund, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
So let's jump into it. So we'll kick off with an agenda today. So we're going to be covering off on the multitude of indicators and data points that are available on Australia's favourite investment asset and covering off on those under information overload. We'll then be looking at three of the key components that we look at and we think are going to be the primary drivers and indicators of where the Australian property market is headed from here. And then we'll be, as always, wrapping up as we do on some investment themes and how we utilise these bits every day at Nucleus Wealth in the MB Fund. So with no further ado, let's jump into it. Information overload, Damien. A quick overview of all housing drivers, and all are not equal.
Why we wanted to put this together, I mean, it's not a day goes by that you don't get some sort of housing stat come out from somewhere about on a whole bunch of different measures that are either going to affect demand or supply or prices of houses. And what we wanted to do is sort of focus in, given we've got this view that now's a pretty critical time for the Australian housing market, we've sort of pointed to the fact that we're expecting a stabilisation. There's not a lot of we don't think there's much upside, but we do think there's a decent bit of downside if you don't manage to stabilise it with the current policies.
Sure.
And so what we wanted to do is really get a feel for what levers and what indicators we're looking at, because not everything comes out on a timely basis as well. There's a lot of measures that only come out sort of once every 3 months or you know, with even greater frequency on some of the annual series that give you a lot of deep insight. Mm. And then you get a lot of sort of very shallow insight from some of the shorter term measures.
Okay.
And our take is that there's a whole bunch of things that do affect the housing prices, but not all are equal. So I've got up a list here of what we're calling sort of what we look at as the broad categories. In terms of the demand factors, we look at credit availability, the price of credit, employment, population growth, foreign buyers, tax incentives, and money laundering as sort of your key bits on what's going to drive the demand side.
Yep.
And then on the flip side, you've got your supply factors, which is your slow land release or restrictive planning, and then over and under supply and building statistics in terms of what's being built on the other side.
Okay. Yep, sure.
So I guess the key thing we wanted to focus in on is that some of these have a much greater effect. So money laundering, for example, Australia's got very weak money laundering rules around the housing market in mm-hmm. particular. And every year, I think for maybe we must be closing in on 20 years now, where it keeps on being promised, yes, we're going to look at that. And then, you go another year and then there's another promise and,
yep.
and it keeps on going. So that's one where it's not a... It does make an effect over the longer term, and, mm. and if you got a big change in it, it might have a shorter term effect.
Yep.
But it's not one which we're expecting any changes soon, and it's not one you need to be sitting watching sort of on a day by day basis. You know what's happening on the money laundering side.
And so by money laundering, we're talking about there a comparison to say other forms of investment asset classes. For example, with ourselves, where if someone wants to invest $35,000 with us, we need passports and driver's licenses and all this what they call AML or know your client.
Who it is.
Yeah. Mm. Before we even open an account to take that sort of money, whereas at the other end of the scale, you can buy a $2 million property and, you know, with shrouds of secrecy and all those sort of things. Is that?
Yeah. And basically, there was a bunch of rules put in. As I said, those anti-money laundering rules were put in maybe 15 years ago. Mm. So it was a post you're following terrorist attacks in the US. There was all these sort of rules put on, and gradually it sort of went through various different markets. But the Australian housing market's always pushed back about being regulated, and so everyone else is regulated. Most other countries have put it in, that's sort of one key area.
Okay.
So following back up the line, tax incentives. There are certainly some very positive tax incentives in Australia for investing in housing, in particular. During the boom years, there were still positive effects. In the bust years, there was no change. and post-election, it looks like there's more changes being made to try and help, you know, whether it be tax incentives or reductions on stamp duty or yep. Or ways to basically backstop people so that people can lend 95, new homeowners can borrow 95% of the value of property. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so all around that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. We're not expecting any major changes there. Foreign buyers, that is one area which we've got some thoughts on, and we'll jump into that a little bit later. Population growth is was big during the boom years. Hasn't been much of a change in it, yep. In terms of population growth. And if you look through the government papers about their forecasts, despite the rhetoric about stopping the boat people and congestion busting and all that type of stuff, they're still factoring in record levels of immigration over a 5-10 year period.
Yep, sure.
So probably population growth is going to keep going the way it's going. Mm-hmm. Employment side is very important, and we'll jump into that a bit later. The price of credit, we had a few rate cuts during those boom years. During the bust years, everything was steady.
Mm.
And then post-election, we've got another couple of rate. We've already had a couple of rate cuts. Yep. We've probably got a couple more to go.
Yep.
But there's limited. We're at the part where it's hard to get. Yeah, we just haven't got any left. So
yeah, sure.
It's unlikely to make a huge effect.
Only a couple more bullets left in the RBA gun, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right. And the big factor was this credit availability one, where during the boom years, that 2012 to 2017 was where we really saw credit ramp up.
Mm-hmm.
And during the bust years, we saw a big fall in it. So that's where our three areas I want to focus on is that credit availability side, the employment side, and also the foreign buyers.
Mm, okay.
So, why don't you jump in quickly as well? Jumping quickly is to the what we call these higher frequency factors.
Yep. Okay. Sure.
Because each one of those factors I've just shown has a multitude of different statistics, and so I wanted to highlight the key ones that sort of give you a short-term view on it, but keeping in mind that these are pretty noisy series. So we get the weekly auction clearances. We get some daily prices coming out of CoreLogic. There's some weekly asking prices, which is a different measure, coming out of SQM. There's some weekly rents, and then but let's jump into some of those just to sort of show. I'll just run quite quickly through these next few slides. For anyone who's not who hasn't got these, I'll try and explain the charts for anyone listening in on the podcast, but also you if you go to the show notes, you'll be able to download the slides.
Yep, we'll have a PDF link there. Yep, no worries. Mm.
So I've just got a quick table up showing the house price movements for the five key cities. This is a daily series that comes out, and it's pretty noisy on a day-to-day basis. You can make it, it's talking about changes of 0.08 of 1%, which is obviously a tiny, tiny change. And the amount of credit you want to give to these statistics on any one day or any one sort of shorter term move is pretty low. But if you look at a chart of these, then you can sort of see a better series about what's going on. And there's certainly been a jump. You can see right at the end of this. So I've got a year's chart up. We've seen prices slide over the course of a year. And then in the last sort of couple of weeks, we've seen this real jump in Sydney, Melbourne house prices, not really in other cities. So that sort of tends to suggest that there's only a few places that are that are really having the effect, really having that same effect. And it's not as much of a, that almost says it's coming back to the investors and the and foreign buyers, because that tends to be that Sydney, Melbourne tend to be the areas where they're strongest, because of I guess credit conditions and other factors affecting the rest of the market in the same way. Now you also get some information from other sources.
We were speaking about this prior to the show, but the interestingly, when I saw this, I immediately thought, hang on a second, I think Perth's fallen over that 1 year period that this chart's showing. It shows that it was Perth, Sydney and Melbourne are kind of in lockstep, but what it isn't, it's omitting is that there was about 3 years of falls from Perth
yeah.
prior to that as well, though. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And Perth's actually a great one we'll move on to later on for the employment side, because Perth throughout the whole credit, well, well, house prices were booming in Sydney and Melbourne.
Yep.
Perth with exactly the same conditions in most factors and same interest rates and, yep, and all yep. those things.
Saw
house prices down 10%. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the question with a lot of this stuff, with a lot of these, is that which of the factors are going to override it? And that's where, you know, we'll get to that employment stage.
Yeah, sure.
So then SQM do a similar measure. They sort of break theirs into houses and units, and they look at sort of three-bedroom houses and two-bedroom units as sort of their base case, and they look at a similar numbers, but they're looking at asking prices. So they're basically just screen scraping and grabbing you know, how much people are looking for from houses, which probably gives a possibly a better feel for some of the shorter term movements, mm-hmm. Because you're talking about this house was listed, you know, last week at one price, and now this week it's, you know, it's that price down. Has been cut.
Yeah, sure.
So, yep. but then again, you know, the actual real prices and whether you're talking about when you get compositional changes, that's where it's quite difficult in these ones as well, because, you know, one week there's a bunch of renovated houses, brand new renovated houses, and then there's another ones that are unrenovated, and so you can get some difference in compositional changes that make an effect.
Yep,
but
sure.
But on that basis, they also have some charts which show this is I'm just showing the Sydney one, and you can certainly see that the houses have turned up at that bottom. Its units are much more difficult. You know, you can at various points in time you could get them going up or going down, but you know, at best I think you're going sideways. I think the glass is half full on that one.
And so units, would that encompass apartments as well?
Yes.
In units? Yeah, okay. Yeah. So there's obviously a bit of pressure on Sydney and Melbourne apartments, but potentially at the moment, given the quality issues that have...
There's quality issues. There's a lot of supply coming on.
Yep.
So yeah, so you've got those types of issues. And the other thing with this, especially when you're getting new units coming on, it's often a lot harder to tell as well. And they tend to... the new units tend to try and keep their price where they are and then give other stuff away.
Yep.
So they'll might pay part of your stamp duty for you or you know, throw in, you know, extra, you know, a car here or something like that.
Yep.
So there's a lot of it. They want to try and keep that price high so that everyone else doesn't sort of all of a sudden cut their...
I saw one the other day where the first year's mortgage payments were thrown in
right.
As part of the deal as well, sort of thing. Probably if you use their mortgage lender, but anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, I guess, the net effect, though, is that, yeah, there's certainly signs that Sydney has turned at the margin. Then you look through to Melbourne as well, and you're sort of seeing very very similar, but again, it's, you know, the houses in Melbourne is a very slight up. And again, the units, it's pretty hard to draw any real conclusions from that.
Yep.
So that's our high frequency sort of daily, weekly data on prices. The other high frequency you get is the auction clearances. And these ones get way more headlines than they deserve.
Absolutely.
I've got a chart up here, which is actually something I think Shane Oliver tweeted not that long ago, but just sort of showing this, that what the levels of auctions compared to the auction clearance rate. So we've had this auction clearance rate, you know, come back to 70%. You know, you can see 80% depending upon who you want to use as your measure for that. But the key thing to note is that it's on very low volumes. Mm. So we're talking about 100 to 200 odd auctions within the Sydney Melbourne market, and of sales that are sort of maybe 1500 to 2000.
Yep.
In those same markets. But the level of auctions at the moment compared with 2 years ago is, you know, 80% lower.
Yep, yep.
And so it's all about this low base effect. So it is. I'm not saying auction clearances aren't important. They are certainly important in terms of tracking the levels, and it does give you a quite a high frequency indicator.
So a snapshot, yeah.
But I wouldn't take auction clearances as a certainly at current levels, at the levels they are at now, at a fait accompli, that this is what's going to happen to the rest of the market.
And it makes sense, because in these sort of lower volume periods, people are putting houses on auction that want to sell potentially. If there's a risk that you know it might not sell or get passed in, as we saw, you know, almost 12 months worth of track record, you're going to market to get rid of it, and you know, obviously that's going to relate very well in the clearance. Just a quick one, actually, just a question that's come through from Gus. Guys, thoughts on reliability of CoreLogic data based on a sudden positive 0.61% jump in one day for Melbourne and Sydney. This was after a week of negative trend.
Yeah, I think there's, I think with any data source that's high frequency like this, where you're trying to, they've got to try and work out within their systems you know, each house price they get that comes in, how much of an effect is that going to make on the total series? And should we let a couple of really big house prices that have just come through bounce the series up, or do we need to make adjustments? And their whole measure is what's called a hedonic measure, which is all about saying, okay, let's, if we're selling a three-bedroom penthouse apartment, then let's not compare. Let's make sure that we're looking at that three-bedroom penthouse apartment, how that's gone over the last 4 or 5 years, and then try and work it out what the effect's been now versus, say, a two-bedroom apartment. Because if you trying to change the mix of it.
Okay.
What you miss out on that as well is the renovations, though, because in the end they go, well, if we've just sold a house, you know, here's a three-bedroom house we sold with whatever features it had.
Yep.
Sold it 2 years ago for $800,000, and now it's just sold for $1 million.
With a pool.
Well, a pool that might actually make an effect, might make a change for. So if they actually went, okay, now it's got a pool on it, and it's sold for $1 million, they might go, okay, well, that might have cost $100,000. Let's reduce it and factor that in.
Yep.
But if it's just a renovation where somebody ripped the guts out and spent $300,000 and, you know, bought it for $800, spent $300, sold it for $1 million.
Yep.
That's get treated as a 25% increase in price.
Yeah, okay. And rather than $100,000 loss.
Exactly. So you do need to treat all of those with a little bit of skepticism about what's actually happening at the asset level. Mm-hmm. But the idea about the overall trend is probably going to be correct. And I think certainly on their monthly ones, they're better with their monthly ones than what they would be in their daily ones.
Okay.
So that's why, and an important point about why you can't really trust the daily ones on a day-to-day basis. But if you're looking at longer-term trends and drawing out graphs, we think that the trends are largely right.
Okay, sure.
And it's very similar with that. Auction clearances is saying there's certainly a lot of dodgy data that goes into auction clearances in terms of people pulling houses and what, you know, what is actually
what's reported,
what's not reported, and all that type of factor. But over a longer time period, if you're cheating the data, they're cheating the data over
consistently.
And so if you're looking at what the trends are, then you get a much better feel for it.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Sure. Yeah. All right. Great answer. All right. So,
getting into what we actually care about now. So the three big factors that investors really should be looking at in terms of housing. The first one is credit growth. Now, I just want to give you taking a step back and saying, well, what's our starting position? Because that's the important part. Is if you look back, sort of in the 1980s, Australia had sort of 50% ish debt to GDP in terms of household debt to GDP.
Yep. Okay.
In terms of its measure. Now we're at sort of 110-ish, well above most other developed countries. I think we're second, you know, on the medal list for being the most indebted from a household perspective.
Yep.
And what you'll notice as well is that we had this huge run up to sort of 2010, 2011, and then this flattening out, and then coinciding with when we saw this housing boom from 2012 to 2017. Is when you saw our household debt take another leg up and as a percentage of GDP. And that's an important factor is that credit is the key driver, one of the very key drivers for household. If credit is available, then house prices, if lots of credit is available, then house prices go up. If credit isn't available, then house prices come down, as we saw with the Royal Commission. So the Royal Commission put a crimp on credit, with pretty much every other factor, you know, unchanged.
Yep.
And that was what saw house prices sort of down 10% in Sydney and Melbourne.
Yep.
And
yep.
So, so that availability of credit. So we've seen a few things come out recently. Actually, let's jump to the next one, which is just looking at credit growth. So we're starting from this really high base. And so the question has to be, how high can it grow? If you look at credit growth over a sort of, I've got a 50-year period chart up here. And what we're looking at is that investor lending is almost zero, which is basically lower than it's ever been for that period. Mind you, investors started 30 years ago, the data. And total lending is sort of under 5% now, which is, again, a low for that entire period. So the part for that is that there's two important factors to come out of this. One is that, yes, it's very low, and so some would argue that means there's lots more upside. You know, look at how we grew from sort of 10 to 20% for all those years in the 90s and 2000s. And you know, my rejoinder to that is that, well, yes, that was because we had 50% debt to equity. Sorry, 50% debt to GDP, and now we've grown it. So it's all a question about how much income can actually support that debt. The other factor is that total earnings growth is total lending growth is just under 5%. But again, that's still above nominal wage growth. So if you've got if you're looking upon this as a long-term series, then you can't expect debt to keep growing faster than wages.
Yep.
Forever.
Yep.
So it has grown for a long, long time. It's grown way faster than wages. At some time, there needs to be a payback.
Mm-hmm.
So you either need to get the wages up, wage growth up, which successive governments have had a lot of problems with, and it's a global problem about it.
Absolutely.
And we've seen sort of various charts from the RBA come out where they keep talking about wages going back to sort of 4 or 5%, and they get it wrong every time.
Revising it.
Yeah. So wage growth is ticking up, but it's well below what we saw on in prior periods. But we've still got credit growing faster than wages. Yep. So we're still getting further into debt.
Yep.
So there's still that disconnect of saying, okay, even though we've had this credit pullback, that still hasn't fixed sort of the situation in terms of the average consumer.
Okay, sure. And before we roll into underemployment, just had a quick question here. Bear with me. Here we go. Thanks, guys. When should existing homeowners fix their mortgage? And we spoke a little bit before about the RBA. Should wait 6 to 9 months until the cash rate goes to 25 basis points. Should anyone be in a rush to fix their mortgage for a potential upswing in RBA rates in the sort of the next year or two?
Our view is very much that interest rates are a stuck world around the world until we see a significant increase in government spending.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's your key to wanting at that stage you're wanting to lock in interest rates if you think when you can actually see yes, governments around the world are serious about actually getting out and doing and putting some serious fiscal support.
Yep.
So until then, we're expecting rates to keep ticking lower.
Yep.
Having said that, I think some of the longer term rates, especially in Australia, the longer term bond rates are largely priced from global perspectives. So yep. So it might not be as much about Australia as you think. So I guess it's a long winded way of saying, look, we're pretty close to the lows at the moment.
Mm.
But if you want to get the final, you want to try and get the final ounce out of it.
Yep.
There might be a little bit more in it.
Yep. Something for mine as well with the whole fixing question over floating or variable is that you pay a premium for fixed normally. So if let's say for example variable gets down to 3% and you can fix for 5 or 10 years, pretty unheard of. But if you could for 4, then you've got to be able to say to yourself, well, I'm comfortable in paying 33% more interest for the next 10 years for the insurance that it's going to go above 4 at some point, and I'm going to make it back. And I don't know if you've got a thought there. Like there's short term fix, but for mine that's more of a teaser rate just to get you on board anyway. If you say to the bank, I want to fix for 30 years, they'll probably say, yeah, great, 5%. Let's do business,
Yeah, well it's very difficult in Australia to get longer term fixed rates.
Yeah.
Yeah. So within other countries, say the US, it's actually very common to have fixed long term sort of 30-year mortgages.
Yep.
And so it's a completely different market in terms of that perspective. So I guess when I'm talking about fixing, I'm talking about fixing for 5 years or whatever your limit is.
Yep.
But given we're not seeing any major changes to the Australian environment and pressure's still low, pressure on interest rates still down, until we actually really start seeing serious government spending, then we'd be saying
variable is your friend. Yeah. Okay, very good. So underemployment.
Yeah, so coming back to that wage growth argument then is saying, okay, well, how can we actually see where else? So why is wages growth so weak? And what we've got is a chart just up here showing the underemployment rate, which is very different to the unemployment rate.
Mm.
So the unemployment rate is basically says if you work an hour or two a week, then you're employed. The underemployment is basically coming back to, would you like to work more?
Yep, okay.
And that's where we can see that the underemployment rate has risen quite significantly over, you know, over that 2012 to 2017 period, and whether that's, you know, the rise of the gig economy and you know, Uber drivers and all these other factors, meaning that people can be employed without actually being fully employed.
Yep.
But what it does show is a very clear correlation between that and wages growth, which we've actually inverted. So wages. The wages growth is on the right hand side, and it's getting weaker and weaker.
Yep.
As underemployment rises. And as you can see, the correlation between those two lines is pretty good. So you really need to see that underemployment come down, and that's where the RBA has been very focused on the unemployment rate and saying about this puzzle about, well, why don't we get more inflation? Because, you know, we've been cutting rates, and low unemployment rate, and so surely that's going to come through when we're going to see all this inflation start flowing through. So we need to be, you know, circumspect about cutting rates any further. And that's sort of their view over that most of that 2012 to 2019.
Mm.
And now they've started to actually realize, hey, that they're looking at the wrong indicator, and there is a bit more focus now on trying to get wages growth up.
Yep.
And they're out exhorting the government to say, why don't you give your workers a pay rise? My take is I don't think the Treasurer or the Prime Minister, who are pretty focused on trying to get to a surplus, and you know, when he asked them to spend more money on infrastructure, they said no.
Yep.
Now they're saying, would you like to give a whole bunch of probably relatively heavily unionized public service employees a bigger wage rise? I think the answer will also be a pretty resounding no as well.
Yeah, okay.
And so, yeah, so wages growth, we're not expecting any significant growth in that. So on the credit side, what you're hoping for now is you're hoping that by freeing up all the credit again and by changing the rules and trying to lend, you know, 95% to first home buyers, we've seen a number of rule changes in terms of APRA and what APRA is trying to do to get things going.
Absolutely.
So sort of we've got the government driving.
What the problem is.
Yeah, let me take one step back. So we had this huge credit boom. We then had a Royal Commission that said, hey, this credit boom shouldn't have happened. You guys were lending irresponsibly. And then now we've got the government saying, hey, and then everyone pulled back and started lending more responsibly and house prices fell. And now the government's going, we need to get house prices going. We need to get credit flowing back again.
Yep.
So we need to get back to lending irresponsibly. And so so there's a bit of a push-pull between between them, but they seem quite dedicated to really pushing that credit out and credit availability out there.
Yep.
So we're sort of in this area where can they be successful or not is a real question. That's where, and so credit growth is that key part, and the take is there's probably limited upside because we're already at pretty maxed out, interest rates are getting pretty low, so we don't think there's a lot of upside in terms of credit growth. But there is downside if they don't get it going.
Mm.
If they don't get credit growth going with the measures they've put in now, we've done all this without a crisis, and yep. we've done this all without unemployment ticking up. If we start to see unemployment ticking up, and we'll speak to that a bit later, then you can't get credit going now, then we're in trouble.
Then we're stuck.
Or house prices are definitely headed yep. a lot lower.
Yep. Okay.
And so we're at this point now. It's an inflection point. We think housing prices can hold, and the government's throwing as much as they possibly can at it to give houses to hold.
Yep.
We don't think there's a lot of upside, but we can see that risk. And so credit growth is one of the key areas we're looking. If the credit growth doesn't come through, then we're going to lower.
Okay, sure.
So then let's go to, that's sort of a good segue into employment. I've got just two different charts up here. One sort of showing what I was speaking about before. So I'm really focusing on Sydney and Melbourne house prices from that 2012 to 2017, plus Perth prices. So the top sort of three lines on this graph. And so Melbourne and Sydney house prices went ballistic and then fell back,
mm-hmm.
and Perth prices pretty much fell right throughout that period.
Yep.
If you then that's on the chart on the left, and the chart on the right, I've got unemployment rates for different states. So, and you can see Western Australia went from sort of sub, you know, it had an unemployment rate of 3%-ish or 3% plus.
Those were the days.
Yep. And that jumped to 6.5% over that same time period.
Yep.
And that to me is the key driver for that house prices. If you get a significant rise in unemployment, then house prices don't go up because there are people out there who have to sell.
Yep. Sure.
Yeah. And so people can get away with low wage rises over a longer period of time. They can just hold on and hold on and, you know, scrimp and save a little bit more.
As long as they have the wage.
As long as they have a wage, yeah. Exactly. When it turns into zero wages,
yep.
Then all of a sudden there's a there's issues.
Okay.
So that's how... So the first one is this credit growth. Second one is employment. So what are the risks to employment? And so... Some of the factors we look at for that is the job ads, and the next slide sort of shows sort of job ads over the last 15 odd years, and we had this massive peak at sort of throughout the mining boom years where job ads were sort of running up to about 250,000, and then crashed back down to sort of 120 odd thousand post financial crisis, bit of a bounce back, but topping out at sort of about 180,000. And in most recent years, so that the 2012 to 2017-18 period, a lot of that growth we saw in was all about growth in construction jobs.
Absolutely.
And yep. And then the flow on from that.
Yep.
And so those jobs, construction jobs, are still ongoing.
Mm.
But we're seeing the job ads and the hiring intentions really start to take a tumble. The last couple of weeks have stabilized. So we were sort of falling off a cliff for a bit. The mm-hmm. last 2 weeks look like they've stabilized a little bit. But there's certainly it's not a good trend in terms of the job ads, and so that's sort of the other, one of the other key areas we're looking at, or one of the key areas we're trying to look at for this employment stage is what is happening on that jobs front, jobs ads can be quite a noisy series. Within that, you can probably see a lot of little spikes and little raises. The part we're going to focus on is the construction employment, and that's where what I've done is shown here. The construction job ads versus the job ads versus the actual construction, construction hiring numbers, and that's where you can see there's a quite a significant correlation between the two, and there's a lot of the thing with construction as well is there's a lot of other flow on jobs that come out of construction, whether it be real estate agents or legal
Hilux,
services,
Hilux salesman,
yeah, exactly. there's a lot of other your Bunnings,
yeah.
all that type of all those other jobs that come out of that. So at the moment, it's pointing to... So construction jobs really haven't fallen very far.
Mm-hmm.
They're sort of pretty close to their peak, but the job ads are pointing to them being 30% lower. And, if the pipeline of what we're seeing in terms of approvals for housing, then that's headed even lower again.
Yep.
So that's your sort of... this is your... your ground zero that in terms of what we should be looking at in the employment side. So credit growth, very important. Next step is employment growth. But most importantly, what's happening within the construction point, because that's where we think things could get ugly. And if they do get ugly enough, you'll see the effects throughout the rest of the economy. And that is your other factor that could drag it all down.
Okay, sure thing.
The final one is more of half a measure. I don't think it's the most important factor driving the market, but it is a very it does make a difference at the margin, and it could easily be a reason for house prices bouncing in the next sort of 18 months. Is what we're looking at here is foreign buyers. Now, unfortunately, there's actually very poor information about foreign buyers. And
a bit of that touches on that anti-money laundering, I think, that we
yeah, absolutely. Started off with. is for a large part, the government doesn't know who's buying it.
Yep.
And so the best you can hope for is some surveys from some of the banks.
Mm. Okay.
And you get a bit of you can get some information from time to time from Westpac, give a bit of information about the amount of lending to various segments. There's a quarterly survey that NAB published about foreign buyers.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see, I've got a chart up there just sort of showing theirs. And so you can see from sort of that 2012 to 2015, basically tripled the demand for new property in foreign demand, and then gave it all back over the next few years as well. So the question now is that reaching a point where the unrest we're seeing in Hong Kong will actually flow through to buyers within Sydney and Melbourne? And at the margin, I absolutely think that's true. The question is, will it be enough to turn around those other factors? We don't think it's... If credit growth and employment turn in one direction, whether up or down, and foreign buyers turn in the opposite direction, foreign buyers aren't enough to overcome.
Yep.
But if there's not a lot happening, then we do think foreign buyers at the margin could make an effect, especially on a positive effect. That's probably your best. If you're a housing bull, that's your best bet, is that you get a bunch of people from Hong Kong wanting to come over and push up.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. And also, I guess, over that time period, particularly I think in the last couple of years, we've seen state governments pulling a few levers on foreign buyers with the, I think it was doubling of stamp duty, or there was a stamp duty surcharge anyway in a number of the major states.
Yep.
So they're sort of, may have milked the cow dry a little bit perhaps, so yeah, slide it up that way.
And so, look, they could certainly reverse those as well at some stage.
Yep. Politically, it might be interesting, but...
Look, who knows? I don't know politically what you know. I suspect they could put a spin on it that makes people, and most people probably didn't see it coming on in the first place, and probably wouldn't notice if it disappeared. But
yep, sure.
I think there is a I think it will make a difference, and I guess they could reverse those if it's all about we have to save the housing market. Let's let foreigners buy again.
Mm.
Maybe that'll get through politically. I don't know. I don't think that's a good argument from an economic point of view. But,
yeah.
But from a whether that politically works up, yeah. So
depends how hard up everybody is to sell their house, I guess. You can just take anybody. But just before we roll into the wrap up, I've just had a quick question here. So the fear, uncertainty, and doom levels around global recession seem off the charts at the moment. Does this add to downside risk for the first home buyer, or do you think it's oversold fear-wise? So global context into local first home buyers is
it's absolutely one. Absolutely important, because the my wrap-up sort of starts with that housing's vulnerable but steady at the moment.
Mm.
Your biggest risk to all of this is that we're throwing everything we can at this housing market to keep it alive. Well, sorry, we're throwing a lot. There's still lots more they can do.
Mm.
But they're throwing a lot at the housing market to try and keep it going at high levels. If you get a global shock of any sort, then the Australian housing market is in big trouble.
Yep.
Yeah. And there's a significant amount of downside to it. So because you're going to get an employment shock, and you're going to get a credit shock as well.
Yeah, sure.
So both our key factors are going to be working in the wrong direction for you. So from a if you're a first home buyer investor,
mm.
I'd be saying, well, I think there's other assets you probably you can hold off and wait. But there's probably going to be if housing market doesn't improve, then there's going to be more bribes for the first home buyers.
Mm.
If you're a first home buyer for living in it, then you're going to make your own decision about whether you're happy to live in that and how long you're happy to live in it and all those other factors. Like there's lifestyle decisions.
Yeah,
which
that's
is different
right.
to an investment decision.
Absolutely.
But as an investment decision, for an investment property,
yep.
I'd be saying there's lots of other assets that have got far less risk. And at a precarious time, do you really want to be stumping up 10, 20, 30 grand in stamp duty or 50 grand in stamp duty?
That's right.
If you need to get out of that thing quickly, you won't be able to get out and you're down that whatever you've just put down as a...
And levered. Right up.
Exactly. So, I don't think there's a lot of upside risk to them. And I do think there is that real downside risk if you get a global shock. All this stuff I've been talking about now is all based on no external global shock.
Mm.
We do think the risks are high in terms of globally. They're not, we don't think they're ready to go just yet, but they're certainly, given the pricing of all these assets around the world, they're certainly not pricing in. Sorry, bonds are pricing in disaster, and equities aren't. So, so there's certainly two different camps on that side. Okay, so that probably leads through the next part. So that we do think this housing. So from an investment perspective, whether this house market manages to hold is really going to drive the Australian economy or not. Getting your housing right over the next 18 to 24 months is going to be key to whether you get your Australian investment thesis right or wrong. We're going with very much of the view that we don't think there's much upside. We don't think there's going to be a bounce back. We think things are going to be steady, but we're protecting ourselves that if anything happens, that you get that downside. And that's certainly there. And watching very closely both credit growth to see whether you can shove more credit growth down people's throats.
Yep.
And that construction employment is to saying, will we see that construction employment continue to come off, which is, we think, is almost a given. But will that then start spreading to other areas of the economy? And that's quite uncertain as to whether that will or not. And so, and the other, the last point I just wanted to make with both those employment and credit growth is they're both what we'd call self-reinforcing. So if you do get credit, if you get, a big amount of government stimulus, say, for example, they decide to go and spend a lot of money on infrastructure, take the RBA's
playbook,
advice, and they go out and they throw all this money at infrastructure, and we get whatever Pink Bats 2.0 ends up being, and
solar panels 2.0,
exactly, and all these other factors, and you got a big push on that. That'll push your employment. That'll mean you can spend. That'll mean your credit can grow more strongly. Credit's growing more strongly. More people are building, means more employment, and you get this positive cycle that takes you higher.
Yep.
On the flip side, they both work in the negative way as well. If you don't get the credit growth or you don't get the employment,
they feed into each other.
Feed into each other, and you can really see that self-reinforcing on the way down. So as I said, precarious position at the moment, certainly vulnerable, and these are the key factors you really should be watching over the next little while.
And just finally, from a portfolio perspective, and thanks for everybody who asked some questions, I'll drop one into mine. So we've got a screen as part of our portfolio screens on investors that are investing with us for limiting Australian housing exposure. It's been quite a popular one over, as you could probably imagine, over the last 6 odd months we've had it in place. Are the themes today, as you mentioned, obviously that gives people the ability to remove stocks that are purposely linked to the Aussie economy and housing in particular. From your point of view, though, broadly, I guess, from our asset allocation piece, just a quick spot on Aussie versus international and how that's sitting in our portfolio and our positioning there as well?
Yeah, we're pretty much minimum weight Australia across all our portfolios.
Yep.
So, and then within those, our housing exposure is not quite minimum weight, but pretty close to minimum weight in most of those, in most of the Aussie parts of those. So, we're certainly not positive at all on that front. A large part of that's that the Australian stock market actually ran up quite hard following the election. And earnings hasn't been particularly strong, and so from a valuation perspective, Australian stock market's very expensive relative to world stock markets.
Okay,
with what we think is a lot more risk and very much leveraged. If you do get a global accident of some sort, then the Australian economy is relatively highly leveraged to world growth, and so we'll probably see commodity prices take a tumble and Aussie equities as well.
Yep. Okay. Fantastic. All right. Thanks, Damien. So coming up next week, same bat time, same bat channel, at the Nucleus Wealth Live webinar page on Thursday the 29th, we will be doing our global trade war update with our chief strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith, who unfortunately was unwell today. And so we had to bump it on to next week. Really looking forward to that one. And so we'll see you there. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.